Harihi Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare
Bhagavat Sandarbha Adhyayana 2 Adhikarna 1 Description of the form of Bhagavan. Okay, page 63. Having denied the Lord's material qualities, the Lord's auspicious eternal qualities are then described in the same work. Nityam vibhum sarva gatam. He is eternal, powerful, and all-pervading. Mundaka Upanishad 1.16. Nirgunam niranjanam means the Lord has no material inferior qualities. If all qualities were absent in the Lord, qualities like eternality, being approachable, and being capable of proof would be denied. Because it's something you can relate to. You can relate to eternity. Right? Because the soul has the nature of eternity. So you can relate to that. It means it's approachable. And you can use it as a proof. You say it's eternal, then it stands that it can't be material, because everything material is temporary. So spiritual means it's eternal. Right? So if it can perform those activities of descriptiveness, and we're able to appreciate it, then the point is it can't be, how you say, then how do you establish that there is the Supreme, right? Even though saying it's Brahman, but how do you establish? You have to have something that you can relate to, otherwise how do you approach it, right? Does that make sense? So that's the whole point is that there must be qualities. So they've said there's no material qualities, and then they say there's qualities. So what does that naturally mean? It means there's no material qualities, there's spiritual qualities. Right? So it's artificial to say there's no material qualities, and then when they describe spiritual qualities, then we say there can't be any qualities. But that's our definition. That's how we would like it to be. Yeah. You know, because it's just easy, right? Because I want everything to work by logic. And so then, you know, a standard logic you see used in so many fields is if something's being done in one way and it's not working, they'll do the opposite. Okay. Rather than find what's wrong with it and solve that. That's the more intelligent person. Mm-hmm. You know, but the general case is just throw everything out, start all over. So that's the thing, is that all this form and everything's giving problem, throw it all out. So, yes, the Lord has no material, we accept that. He has spiritual qualities, no, he can't have. But the point is if they're only accepting half of the, you know, the chicken, that's all. Tell me something. Brahman has a sarup of knowledge alone, according to advocates of pure knowledge. But even then, in his sarup, Brahman is a knower. He is not without qualities. Thus, Brahman should be accepted as being blissful, ananda maya. Because if by knowledge you'll become blissful, why wouldn't Brahman be blissful? Otherwise, then where is the position if you become Brahman and you're not blissful then? Because they say Brahmananda, the bliss of Brahman, that means Ananda's there. That means it's experienced. Right? Yes. So Brahman, otherwise, if you are Ananda but don't know you're Ananda or experience Ananda, then what's the whole point? How can it be a goal? So many sons. Nothingness can't be a goal unless you're really angry. Does that make sense? Yeah. In many places, the word Brahman clearly indicates the Lord with qualities, since Brahman means that which expands. Anandam Brahmano Vidvan. He knows the bliss of Brahman. Taittiriya Upanishad 2.4.1. This indicates difference or qualities in Brahman. Yato vacho nivartante. Words cannot describe Brahman. Taittiriya Upanishad 2.6. This means that the Lord cannot be described because He's unlimited and beyond material comprehension, rather than having no qualities. Right? Because if He's beyond, that's why you can't describe. So then you can give examples of something this close. It doesn't mean it doesn't work. Right? Especially since the Shastra is giving that. So Shabda is always accepted as authority. This does not contradict the following. Brahmate Bruvani Brahmavid Apnoti Param. I will speak to you about Brahman. Wow. That's impressive. Means I completely rearrange the sentence and it makes sense. That's the thing. If it makes sense, it'll just be rearranged. If it doesn't make sense, it'll never do it. The knowledge, the knower of Brahman attains the supreme. Taittiriya Upanishad.
Then what did you say?
I will speak to you about Brahman. Yeah. Ramanujacharya says, the following statements are made. When he sees duality, he sees things other than Brahman. When all the senses of the liberated jiva become filled with the Lord Shakti, how does he see and what does he see? He sees the Lord by senses endowed with the Lord Shakti. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad 4.5.15. Right, so then, the Upanishads are explaining everything very clearly. We may not be used to the concepts, but as you see as we go on and we're getting more accustomed to hearing these things, it's very straightforward, very simple. That's why it says it's a disservice that the commentaries are made so that it gives an indirect meaning when the direct is so clear and it works so well. But it solves all the problems. There's no faults come up. Right? There may be some doubts, but that's the whole point. That comes up in anything. You want to do anything, there's always a doubt. That's how intelligence works. Intelligence means you clear doubts. Right? Having cleared doubts, then you can see mechanically how things work. Right? Yes.
So it seems that we follow we always follow some other person, other ideas.
That's because, especially now, because if you're on the platform of pranamaya, you will follow someone else's.
Yes.
But even if we're following shabda, it's coming from others. That's what tradition is. It's coming from others. Then you have the Vedas. It's still about others.
And after, we just need to select what are the other people who are going to.
Yeah, who are the others? Yes, because in some cases the others can be a real problem.
Yes.
But if you have the correct. Then the point is, if it's the Lord and those connected to the Lord, those who know the Lord, the Sauris,
yes.
Then it's going to work out.
It is normal that person who are not in the parampara, they follow something who is not correct.
Yes.
It's normal, I guess.
It is normal. So the whole point is if you're working within the same area, then... for lack of a better way to say it, if you're lost,
yes,
then these others in the same category,
yes,
are a problem. But if you're lost and you take those from outside that category,
yes,
from the transcendental,
yes,
then you will also become transcendental.
Yes.
That's what Upanishad is saying. Come from the dark to the light.
Yes.
Right? So it has to be appreciated that.
Yes. This idea, when we see duality, if we stay in duality, means we follow some people who are in duality.
The point is, you're in duality, then duality will make sense to you, right? Either logically or even just emotionally. Nowadays they say it'll resonate.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So that's the whole point. You will take. So that's why it means different people become very popular, but they're only popular in certain circles.
Yes.
And within that circle, then, you know, it's the whole world. And because you only know that circle, you think that they're popular to everyone. But they're not. They're only popular to your particular group. Your group might be a little bit wider range or volume. But it's not beyond that. And then there's all these different combinations of the modes.
Mm-hmm.
So someone will speak on the mundane plane, and it will make sense as the modes drop. Let's say even in the in India, then you have the sense of renunciation. And, you know, is better than attachment.
Yes.
Right, in all just spheres of society. So, because coming from the Vedic, it knows it's higher. Then the impersonalist can function in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so they'll be attractive on that platform. It is known as higher, but those who are lower don't get attracted to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're all following Shastra.
Yes.
Right? So the Karmis, Gyanis are following Shastra, and so the Gyanis will stay in the Gyana area, the Karmis will stay in the Karma area. But it's all on Shabda. Now, when Shabda becomes not so important, you know, then you see is that those who are following the impersonal, they drop down.
Yes.
Because then why would you be renounced? It's all about enjoying yourself. Right, you may be a bit of a pessimist, but you still want to enjoy yourself, right? And if we're not dealing with it as the modes drop, then we're not going to be dealing with duty. We're not going to be dealing with something that's beyond,
yes,
you know, transcendence.
Yes.
And so then, we're going to be interested in that which can give us happiness.
Yes.
But at the same time, as we said, if we're, you know, when we're accepting the scriptures, then it said exactly what you should do. So if you're going to take that detached aspect or go beyond, you have to be detached. Right? If you're going to take gyan, you have to be detached. But as you move away from scripture, now you can be impersonal, but be attached. Because what's defining it? Who's saying you can't be? And as it was pointed out, who's talking about? Who made the point that all modern philosophies can be categorized within impersonalism?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the catch-all for anything that's not Vedic and not personal.
Yes.
Prabhupada was saying that. So, because it comes down to if everything's God, then you can do anything. You know, that's the interpretation. So when we see we see here that this was going on, so we can do that, but they're not catching the actual point.
Mm-hmm.
They're catching the secondary aspect. I want to do the secondary, but the scriptures restrict it, so I'm not doing it. But I see here is an example of someone who is doing that, but I'm not catching why they're doing it or in what context. You know, like that. Does that make sense? So that's the thing is, so then if it's all one, I'll use it to advantage, that then therefore it's all for sense gratification. You know, so therefore you have the transcendental achinta beta beta tattva, and then you have kind of the more mundane one, you know, all for one and one for all. Like that, you know. Everyone likes the Musketeers, right?
Yes.
Yes, so then.
In America also.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's big, it's big. They've done a lot of films on the Musketeers. Like that, you know. What's not to like about the Musketeers, I think?
So we like to follow Maharaj. We like to follow something.
Have to follow something. That's the thing, because we're personal. We're always going to fall. See, the thing is that for the jiva, in the natural state, they understand that they're part of something, because you're not an illusion. And so whatever happiness in that you're having is coming from a superior source.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, then one connects oneself to that superior source and serves that superior source. That's the natural tendency of the living entity. But the problem is that in becoming envious, then we think that, well, I can enjoy these things on my own. So you leave out the Supreme. and then think the mechanics can be enjoyed on their own. Because everybody's using the mechanics, but they're using it to please Krishna. That here, you, if you get envious, you think, I'll use the mechanics to serve myself.
It's an interesting phenomenon that generally Hindus in dealings with each other, they're quite personal, but
yes,
in philosophy is completely impersonal.
Yes.
But then in the West, in dealings, people are very impersonal.
Yes.
But then they have some kind of, you know, personal concept of God. The God, you know, I mean, whatever it is, but it's strange.
Yeah, no, it's strange. Well, that's just because the but we, how you say, from that, from the monotheistic point of view. But if you look at it, it's very similar also to the Hindu thing, that they'll worship demigods as people, but ultimately they're impersonal.
Yeah.
So the Western monotheism is, it's about a person, but ultimately impersonal. So in that way, it's not so different.
Yeah.
But the advantage is the monotheistic aspect. So that's the strong point there. That's why then when you bring up philosophy, it catches much easier. But as you said, the impersonal in the religion, they don't catch the religion. Well, the Hindus then, they are more personal because they follow the religion, or at least closer, some semblance of it. So then when they come in contact with the proper religion, it can be easier for them to follow. You know, unless they get too attached to, you know, the particular mode of goodness or that they've been functioning under. You know, you can always be attached and get stuck. You know, so they always want to, you know, if we don't worship this or that or, you know, certain things, or, you know, they're always worried because it's auspicious. Auspiciousness means then you're going to get good results. Good results means facility. Good facility means enjoyment. So they're worried, if I don't do this, I'll miss out on that, rather than Krishna takes care. So if they have that faith, then they give that all up and it works nicely. But if not, then you'll see it has that little bit of a mix. But both of them have their strength, but they both have their weakness. So one is philosophically strong, religiously weak. The other one's religiously strong, philosophically weak. But of the two, if you're not dealing with the problem of attachment to the mode of goodness, and because of that conditioning, one thinks everything's fine, then it will actually be easier for the person from the Hindu background to catch both the philosophy and the religion. You know, fine points of it. The faith, that's another thing that has nothing to do with the background. That's an individual aspect of the soul. So any soul could, by association, gain that faith. So you'll see is that in the West, they'll gain the faith, they'll take up, you know, the obvious things. But when you start to get into the subtle and other fine points, that aren't easily caught because there's no samskars or impressions to build on. Because, you know, you have to build on something they don't have. So it takes much longer for them to see and experience and all that. But let's say for someone from a Hindu background, then for them it would be easy because they do have those experiences, though for them it wasn't necessarily that important or that prominent. But they have seen it. They've seen that religious grandmother, or they've been to the temple, they've gone for festival. You know, everybody will go for a Janmashtami or a Ganesh Chaturthi or something. They'll all go for something. You know, they'll all fast. You know, so they know about these things, and they all know how to, you know, get up, they take their bath, and, you know, all these things like that. These things are just part of the lifestyle. So it's just a matter of, if they have the faith, they'll bring it all the way through to Krishna and then see it in that context, and it'll go really well. If they don't, then they'll get stuck a little bit more on the religious side and not so strong on the philosophy side. So they'll kind of be in the same position as the Westerners if they don't have that really strong faith also. They'll get stuck on the philosophy and not catch the religion. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Here, stuck means, there's two ways to be stuck. Stuck means they can't get anywhere, or stuck means you're totally into it and can't get anywhere. You know, the two aspects of Niyamagraha. So you get. So that's why then Prabhupada said, lame, bland, blind man. So that was the... Yes?
In Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, during his last days, he was giving a lecture. There are many elite people around. So there was one king of some Banswarya area. He was telling, yesterday I heard that you are coming, and immediately I remembered you, and then I became very emotional, something like that. Then interestingly, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that because you are doing deity worship nicely, that's why you have become personal, you are able to remember me.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, so they do deity worship, so then they're... Now, of those, you may find that those who have more of a religious process and more of that will tend to be a little bit more personal than those who don't. You know? So it's just like that. So it'll come down. So then the most personal, like you're saying, because they have deities and all that. And there's some, and the Orient, if you get to know them, they worship deities, and you know, they do service. So that's why it's an important part, it's an important anga of the chanting is the deity worship. Because for us, it's not being transcendental ourselves in realization, then the Pancharatra gives the perfect support. You know, because then you're dropping into the context of the body and senses and the mind, but always connected to Krishna. So then it's a strong position. So generally devotees do well there. It's if they have more desire or need to interact beyond that, then unless they can relate to the Vedic, they have a lot of problem. You know, it's just like I remember seeing once is that we had something. I saw one devotee, something went wrong, and they got called down to the police station. It means it wasn't the problem with them; it was a problem with someone else. Someone else was somehow not at the police station, you know, and the police are all grumpy and all that. And then this devotee from here, from Mayapur, he's called in. Has nothing to do with him. He doesn't know them. He doesn't know the guys like that. As soon as he walks in, he's smiling. He's giving out prasad. He's doing this whole thing like that, sitting down and all that. And they're all looking, you know, very serious. Oh, what's the problem? And, you know, and they're saying, oh, yes, you know, I understand. And he's doing this whole number. And within 5 minutes, then that person and the person that was under their custody was walking out. Because they just know naturally how to just be personal, interact, deal with, you know, their authorities. You respect them. You know, they have power. You have to deal with that. It's not just you come in, well, what are you guys? You know, who do you think you are to keep? You know, that's what Westerners would do. Yeah, and then you both end up in jail.
And beaten.
Huh?
And beaten.
And beaten, yes. As a bonus. Yes, as a bonus. You know, so it's just, they know how to do these things, and so they just deal on the personal level. One happens to be a policeman, one happens to be, you know, like this. And so it works. Because the person, that's why religion is there. So it's said that varnashram is for material maintenance, you know, maintenance of the body, mind, and words like that. So therefore, that's why it's so good, because it always works in all situations with everybody, because you're actually dealing with the human element. Well, otherwise, they pick out qualities, but it's not that it's about human application, because those good qualities, animals have them. Deers are gentle, they're nice. Like that, you know. So it's just you have these things. It's not personal enough. But as Prabhu pointed out, we're getting that from, we're hearing from people that, so we just take that pranamoyic aspect. You know, that's if we actually care. You know, well, in the Vedic, then it'll be the theistic aspect. It'll take from scripture, from authority, from elders. And then you see as you come out and people are still have a value in religion, and that in the tradition, then they'll still have some of that strongly there. Of course, it always will have some weakness. But, you know, each group will have a different weakness. This side of the fence, everything goes on and things are, you know, how you say the women are quite strong, you know, and it works. But if you go to the other side of the fence, then for the men to function, the women have to be, you know, really kept down and all that for them to feel good about themselves. But, you know, but because the women are so strong, but at the same time, as you know, they have to find another way to make it work. You know? So that's the thing, is each community will have its own thing. But in the Vedic, that's the funny part, that's the one that's universal, because you're dealing with humans. So you can use the Vedic culture anywhere, the principles of it, and it will always work. You know, example of how Srila Prabhupada went and made it work. You know, like that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, dealing with the British, it worked. You know, that, you know, he didn't have to force that. That governor was, you know, happily coming down his newly built road. You know, those other, you know, English party are happy to be there for, you know, tea with the sadhu. You know. So they appreciate because of the cult. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he moved very well in this society. He was greatly respected because they're using the Vedic culture, right? Sometimes external details you make a difference, but the point is that the principles you never drop, and that's what's not known. So the Vedic it's a set of principles, and then you have the natural form to express those principles that you would naturally use if you could. And if you can't, then you use the next best. You know, on down to, you know, 10th best. So, no? Okay. Okay. By the mind, okay, so this is still Ramanujacharya, huh?
Yes.
By the mind, oh, so now he's commenting on the verse. Yes. By the mind, one can understand there is no difference in the Lord. He who sees difference goes from death to death. Katu Upanishad 2.1.11. Yeah. Because in the mind you can see it, but then intelligently you say, no, it can't be. You know, that's sentiment. But the point is what they're not catching. It's the mind that runs things, not the intelligence. Right? It should be that the mind is controlled by the intelligence, so you're choosing from intelligent decisions. Right? Rather than just whimsical. You know, from authority. But it doesn't mean that the intelligence ever makes a decision. Intelligence does not make decisions. The mind does. Right? So that's the point. The mind can understand there's no difference. But he who sees the difference, why? Because of intelligence. Because the mind sees means, you know, accept something and reject something. So it can either, and the intelligence, what's the difference? What's the same? So the mind can either accept sameness or reject sameness or accept difference or reject difference. Right? Does that make sense? So here is the mind's accepting difference where there is no difference, and saying there's no difference where there is. That's because of the intelligence, you can come up with that as an option. You know, it's just like we can put the microphone like this, we can turn it, we can turn it upside down, we can try to balance it on one leg, you know, we can do all kinds of things. If you do it like this, it works nice. So, yes.
Sometimes it's not clear if those two are different.
Which? The mind and intelligence?
Yeah, mind and intelligence. Then mind, according to the mode he's in, he will make certain decisions. And then intelligence has nothing to do with that, apparently. So how...
How does that work?
Yeah.
Okay. See, is that the thing, what needs to be factored in all this? Because when we discuss the mind does this, intelligence this, false ego this, we're talking about the mechanics and the modes that they're working with.
Right.
And how they relate to each other. What needs to be factored in is consciousness. Right? So that's where the modes are. Because polluted consciousness means it's come under the modes. Pure consciousness means no modes. Mm-hmm. So it's the consciousness of the living entity that's why then the mind will function in that capacity. So the same person with the same mind then can function in a higher capacity by association and these kind of things. Or in the lower one by bad association. Mm-hmm. Right? Depending on the modes you're associated with. So they need to have. So the idea is, if you associate with pure devotees, then you start using the spiritual mind, intelligence, and ego. Right? So now when we're looking at it, we say that there's three, but they function as one, just like Buddha Yoga, right? You have Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Dhyana Yoga. And we study them separately. We know each one how they do, and then Krishna shows how Karma and Jnana, you use those together, so you get nice karma. And then the meditation, and you know, you're going to, how that works, so then you connect that to the Lord. But you never use one at a time. You're always using all three. It's just a matter of the proportion, which one's being used. Does that make sense? The one thing. So that's why you can call the antakarana just mind. So when we say there's 16 elements, we're taking all four of the subtle body and calling it mind. Does that make sense? And then when we take it down and we say there's seven elements, right? Then we're going to be, is it seven or nine?
Sometimes it says nine, eight, or seven.
Okay. But when you take it down, then the Pancha Mahabhuta is counting for 20 items. Right? Five are representing 20 because they all kind of connected and come from each other. And then you're going to have the mind. And then you're going to have, what do you call it? Mahatattva. Right? And then you're going to have Pradhan. Or you can even just say Pancha Bhuta. The Mahatattva, because that means sutra, so that's what the mind's thinking, and pradhan. Because you have to have the ingredients, so without pradhan you don't have ingredients. Then without the mentality that's there, and the subtle and the metaphysics, then you won't have that, so that's all the subtle aspects. So that will also include the mind, and the modes, and everything like that. Then the Mahabhutas will be the 20 items that make the gross that you see in the interaction with the gross. Does that make sense? So, the mind means all these three working together. Because the mind then has two features. You have what's called manas, which means how the mind works with the senses. You know, it's assisted by the intelligence, because the intelligence, the sense tells the difference between things and same and all that. So that's intelligence. That's why it said, Prajumna is the Lord of the senses. Right? Because intelligence actually mechanically engages the senses. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, let's say you're doing some work, you know, let's say some road work or something like that. So you hire one of those JCBs, right? So the JCB is doing what you want it to do, but you're not technically, mechanically running it. The guy sitting inside is. So the mind, the senses are dealing with what the mind wants to deal with, but it's the intelligence that's actually mechanically making them function. Right? So in this, we won't say the guy in the JCB is building the road. We'll say you're building the road. So that's why we'll say mind. Even though intelligence may be mechanically doing it. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, yeah. So then that's one aspect. That's the manas. Then the other aspect is called chitta. Right? So it's known as polluted consciousness. Right? So that means now you're dealing with the mind with the consciousness. Because without even being conscious, the senses are functioning. Right? So the means you have to be at least awake, that much conscious. But you know. So the chitta then means where all that's functioning together. So that's why sometimes you see in different definitions or descriptions of it, it sometimes seems there's overlaps or it's broken down in very different ways, you know, of what the steps are. Because in here, it's just all that's combined. So depending upon what how you're explaining it, if you're focusing more on mind, intelligence, false ego, then you're going to show the steps in one very clear way. But if you're dealing with it as chitta, where it's all together with the consciousness, then you're going to show the same thing, but certain things will be combined and all that because it's already been explained in the other one, in the mechanical one. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like you say, do this, the guy will mechanically do those things. So if I'm saying, how does the JCB work, I'll explain that. And then when you say, okay, do this part of the road, that part of the road, that's the important thing, he'll do all those things, but it's not about those mechanics. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
So then what's going to happen is that the information is going to come in through the senses to the and the manas, right? Like this. Out of that, it'll have to be reduced down, right? And then it'll be taken from that point of reduction into now trying to see what. Now you're going to go into you convert into the. Into basically, you could say, the field of samskaras. Right? Because before that, it's the field of the senses. So that's abstract. So you want to convert it into the field of concrete, which is your impressions. Right? So then you have to look at, so then the first thing will be is the mind will access the memory of the intelligence. Right? And from that, you're going to look for where is there, if there's anything from the past or anything like that that you deal with, you know, and how you're going to start. So to do that, now you have to take the thing and reduce it down. You have to be able to, with the intelligence, reduce it down into something that it becomes one. You can categorize it. So if you can't, that's why somebody that you show them or explain something that they have no categories for in their experience, they can't understand it. Even though it's very simple. So that's what examples are for. Examples are, you're trying to bridge that gap between their impression and this and the knowledge you're trying to give to create the new impression. But that's how education's working. You know? So then, having done that, now having reduced it down, so you have a category, now within the category, you can expand it. What are the different ways it can be put together, what it is? Because otherwise, unless you can categorize it, what do you do with it? Does that make sense? Yeah. And so, this point where you're taking it and finding all the different things and options that are there, that's that, and then choosing, that will be called reasoning. You know, that's what we call the power of reasoning. But in that, it's you're going through options that are there. The mind is accepting and rejecting, mm-hmm. and at the same time, as you have the false ego that's there, or the ego. In any case, the ego that is your identity that the mind is going to choose based on, right? Because so many options are there, but according to your identity, you can only use certain ones, mm-hmm. right? Unless you want to change your identity. Mm-hmm. You know, does that make sense? But that's the point. Your identity is your security. That's who you are. That's how you fit in. So you're going to function according to that. So you see, in the reasoning, you're using all three. But the emphasis is on the intelligence. It's coming up with what are all the options. Does that make sense? So, in other words, once you've gotten to that point where now the mind has accepted that accepted and rejected that category. You know, it's accepted the category. Now the intelligence is showing, okay, we can do all these things. And then, you know, the mind will look at the ego and it'll go, I don't know. You know, that'll go out until we have, well, maybe those are, you know, until then it comes down to what's that. And then it's a matter of, then also then the samskaras, the impressions on that, what you get the maximum out of and all that. So you can see all these things are all happening together. You can't break it down into its individual things, but they're all happening together. Because at each point, they're all going on. And then, having chosen one, now the mind chooses, I'm going to do this. You know, then you have that determination and focus and like that. Then, it'll go back to the manas, where the manas now will engage the senses to accomplish. Mm-hmm. Like that. So, the citta is there. So, that's then the meaning of when they say heart. What you feel, what's important to you and all that. So, when you just say citta, the polluted consciousness, it means that place where all these functions are going on. But when it says heart, that means what you consider concrete, and therefore why you deal. You know, and you as you know, in that individual context, how you'll deal with others in context. So if you do it personally, you'll say they have a heart. They don't, it's just mechanical. Right? So they're not dealing that. So the heart generally encakes that personal. So that's the natural way for the living entity to deal. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I came across this verse. It's like we are discussing about Anandamaya Purusha.
Yes.
That is the fifth verse in the 2.1 of Katopanishad. The four verses before describe Annamaya, Pranamaya, Manomaya, and Vijnanamaya Purusha.
Okay.
The interesting part is in the Manomaya Purusha, it's dealing with mind. There, the five aspects described as Yajur Mantras are the head, Rig Mantras are the left arm, Sama Mantras are the right arm.
Which was the head?
Yajur.
Okay.
And then Brahmanas are the torso. Okay. And in the explanation, it's tell because the action, performing action, is actually the main function of mind. So, by chanting all the mantras, by engaging all the Vedas, we are actually arriving at the conclusion of performing right actions. Then in the Vijnanamaya Purusha, it is described that faith is the head, intelligence is the left arm, attempts to finding the real meaning is the right arm, and finding the real meaning is the torso. The main function of intelligence is then comes at Vijnanamaya level that
it finds the proper conclusion. The proper conclusion meaning there is spiritual rather than just, you know, what's the good thing to do. Interesting. You see why the Acharyas put a lot of emphasis, the Upanishads, on these. Like, I never understood that the Vedanta Sutra, that first pada, is dealing with these Purushas. You know, because generally the translations, they don't come out that so strong.
No, it seems that this higher level of consciousness is a very important topic.
It is. It's a very major topic. You see, Prabhupada's always bringing it up. But we've just dealt with it just on basically where you're getting your, you know, how you say, just the, what field you work in. And then we got a little bit more, the Bhakti Vijnan Maharaj, and he came across it, that these five levels, but where the information, where do you get your knowledge from for each of these five? Right? You know, that's the Pratyaksha, Paroksha, Aparoksha, what is
it?
Adhokshya and Aprakrita. Right, where are you getting your information? Then the anamoy prana, that's the field you're going to use this information in. You know, where you're getting it from, where you're going to use it. Like that. And then here it's showing the Purusha. Then within that, what are the mechanics that make it work? What makes it solid? So that means anamoy, then the stomach is the torso?
Anamoy is like the whole body, normal body is described. In the pranamaya, then prana is the head, vyana and apana is the right and left arm, and then the ether is described. Ether is the torso.
Okay. Yeah, because in the space, then you can do all that. So that's why I guess it's always so impersonal.
This is from which? Where is he quoting from?
Yeah.
You said Katha Upanishad.
Katha. It comes in the next.
Katha Upanishad. Everybody talks about it. So if it's been given a detail in one, then everybody else is just going on from that. That's the thing about the Veda. If it's been clearly described in one place, generally everyone else just refers to it. Unless it's something so important that you need to bring it up, then it'll be. Or they'll only refer to the part, the detail of the part they're explaining. Because you have a similar principle in knowledge in the Shikshavali. In Taittiriya Upanishad, what's the upper, what's the lower, what's the what connects it together, and all that. So these are all the Upanishadic, how they approach knowledge. You see, because it's all by that principle, and the philosophy, the metaphysics, you know, then the practical, they come down from there, and then a very different vision, like that. Right, well, we saw Pratyaksha is just a regular old body. You know. So the mantra for that is what the hip bone is connected to the thigh bone, like that. Yeah. Good. You know, it's impressive. This is the first time all of this has ever made sense. You know, I mean, we can just talk about it as just like, yeah, you know, and so it's like, you know, you can go on this road to the temple, but you know, it's too many pilgrims. You can go, when you get to the restaurant, there's too many people around, you know, the stand there. You can kind of go around the back of the restaurant and come out on the main road. And, you know, it's kind of like that. It's just, yeah, of course. Okay. So these statements of oneness indicate that Jiva and Maya are the Lord's Shaktis, that the universe is the effect of Brahman, and that the Lord is within everything. Right? So he's giving everything, the relations of everything, they're all in one place. So, though material variety is denied, this does not deny all qualities, right? So in the Lord. Since scriptures accept internal difference in the Lord. Bahu Sham Prajayaya. The Lord desired to create progeny. Taittiriya Upanishad 2.6.1. Difference in the form of effects is here accepted through his inconceivable Shakti. Though the Lord is without change, right? So his Shakti will change because he has difference, therefore his creation will have difference. But he doesn't change because it's his energies that transform. The variety in Brahman cannot be understood by proofs like sense perception, right? Because they're beyond what your senses can see. Thus, to negate the qualities of the Lord by the negative statement, Neha na nasti kinchana, is a foolish idea. Sri Bhasya 111. This is what he opens with. Okay. Okay.
This is the starting.
Yeah, this is the start, first verse.
This is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati on?
No, this is Ramanujacharya.
Oh, okay.
Like that.
Yeah.
The Ramanujacharya, from the first verse of Sri Bhasya, means of Vedanta Sutra. So his commentary on 111, Atato Brahman Jigyasa. So this is this is only part of his commentary. I'm sure that it's, you know, huge. So just Neha Nanasti Kinchana means whatever exists in Brahman is not of material variety, but variety in his very sarup. Right, so that's a very important point. Right, so the thing is that there is no material variety in the Lord, therefore it's spiritual variety. So that's a sarup, that's a non-difference. Because we have to remember, as if we're looking at, see, another major fault comes up, is that if we're looking at it, okay, I'm dealing with forms and everything here in the material world, it's giving trouble. So spiritual must mean the opposite, right? Now, the difficulty comes in that, and so now I'll say, so Brahman, who is the absolute, the transcendence, can't have any form or qualities. Mm-hmm. But the thing is I'm basing that on what? Right? I'm observing energy, and then giving the Lord qualities based on energy.
Yes.
Not Shaktiman, not the source of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's why it's there. So then, so being the source of energy, then if there's energy, he has to be the source of that energy. That means there has to be transcendental qualities for there to be a reflected here as untranscendental qualities. But at the same time, since he doesn't transform, then what transforms? Energy. And we see here energy transforming. You take earth, you take it out, you sift it, you take out all the rocks, that, then you just end up with the clay, then you add water, and then you make it malleable, then you make it into various shapes and different things, and then it has one kind of thing, then you fire it, then it has another level. You know? Like that. You sometimes even see in that when they open the kilns, when they do the bricks, nowadays I can't say, but before, when they burn them for like some weeks and that, then the right where the heat goes in, those first bricks generally are glass. They turn into glass. You know, and then after that, then you have what's called the picket, the really hard ones. If you hit them, they ring, but they're kind of a little bit bluish, reddish, and they not necessarily have a good shape because the heat just has twisted them. Then after that, then you get your good bricks, you know, and then after that, then the not as good bricks, and then you get the ones at the end they call ama, which means undigested. You know, they're the ones, if you drop them, they'll just turn into, you know, little pieces. Like that. So the thing is, it is that transformation,
mm-hmm.
right? You can take earth, everyone can see, energy transforms. So now there has to be a source. That means an energetic. That's what doesn't change. The electricity, you can do so many things with it, right? The generator does one thing. It's the source of now, once I get the electricity, I can raise the voltage, I can drop the voltage, I can do so many things with it. You know, that's where you have a transformer. It takes energy and transforms it into another form of energy. Does that make sense? So because of not understanding this fundamental point, that they're trying to give their qualities onto the Lord. So it's actually aropia. They're taking their own vision and imposing that on the Lord. When the Lord is different, that's why you can't know him by the senses. But by knowing what we do know through the senses, with knowledge from authority, then we can appreciate that the same thing is there, you know, in the original, but in the pure state, the natural state. Right? So that means the qualities there, the variety there, that is Ananda. Because if he's the Ananda Maya Purusha, then it must be Ananda. While we see here, it's not so Ananda. Otherwise, why would we be worrying about it? Right? If everybody was like perfectly happy in the material world, would there be anybody discussing philosophy or stuff like that, becoming monks or, you know, doing austerity? No. So, yeah? Yes.
So can we say that in spite of that impersonalists accept authority of whether they still use inductive?
Yes, they're still using inductive because they're starting with themselves and trying to transpose that all the way up to the Supreme. And then they're saying it's not logical if it's something other than that. But the point is real logic, if you look at it, you know, if there's energy, there has to be a source of that energy. Because they never explain the source. You know, like that. It means you have Ishwara, and that comes from Jnana, right? Which is Brahman covered by that. And where does that come from? That comes from the Jiva's contemplation, or whatever it is they come up with it. You know? Like that. And then where the Jiva, that's when Brahman is covered by Ajnana, you know, or illusion. Where does the illusion come from? That they don't explain. They can't explain. At this point, they'll just go, oh, it's a Chintya. That's exactly the point. It's a Chintya. It's coming from the Lord. So that's the difficulty, is that they're unable to. So if they just accept that the Shakti, that the Brahman means it's the Shakti Man, and then there's Shakti, then that transformation then is not a problem. Because in their philosophy, they're accepting transformation. But if they take it back, well, that comes from Brahman, so it's Brahman that transforms, then their philosophy falls apart again. If they say, no, it's Shakti, so Brahman is unchanging, then where does this Shakti come from? That they can't explain, so that means their philosophy is incomplete. Right? So they can see is that Shakti is transforming. But what they're not catching is where is it from? And so if Brahman is unchanging, that means Brahman can be the source of Shakti and still be unchanging, because the Shakti changes. He doesn't have to change. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yes? Good. Otherwise, the word nana, variety, would be superfluous. Nothing exists in Brahman already includes not having variety. Right? Because you're saying variety is there. Right, so then you have to be able to appreciate that this means there's variety, because it's his sarup. There's no material variety, but the variety is there because it's his sarup. Taking it that nothing exists in Brahman, you know, it means that there's no variety. So then there's nothing there, and it doesn't actually explain everything. It's not a complete enough philosophy, because this must be one of those ones where, depending on where you break it, you end up with these two meanings. Bhuma is that in which one sees nothing else, hears nothing else, and knows nothing else. Where one sees something else, hears something else, or knows something else, one knows something insignificant or small. Brahman is immortal and everything else is insignificant and temporary. Chandogya Upanishad 7.24.1, right? So then he's saying one sees nothing else that means other than the transcendental. He hears nothing else other than transcendental. He knows nothing else other than Brahman. He sees where he sees something else other than that. Right now he's seeing duality. So then he knows something insignificant, right? Because now here Brahman is immortal, and everything else is insignificant and temporary. So that then defines then what it is that you're the nothing or the hearing. Right. Yes.
So what would be the difference between variety and duality? Because sometimes people mix it and confuse.
Yeah. Variety will be what's inherent within. Duality means you see it separate from. So in this case, is that the Lord and His energies, if you see it as separate, then that's duality. If you see that they're non-different, but it's variety, then that's what we're talking about. So then he's non-dual. So that's the thing, because they separate it from the Lord. It's a mundane concept, right? Because the living entity has that opportunity to be with the Lord, and they have in an environment where everything is being connected to the Lord, but not really finding that interest. They turn their attention away from the Lord, where they see all the forms and activities and that of not connected to the Lord. Right? But you're doing that from the platform of I can be happy with that. So you take up that aspect of karma. Right? And when that doesn't work, then you're keeping the same philosophy, is that all the variety doesn't connect to the Lord. You understand? The karma, it's not connected to the Lord, so I can enjoy it. The gyan is, it's not connected to the Lord and I can't enjoy it. Right? So one's an optimist, one's a pessimist. But both of them are mundane because there's no connection of the energy with the Lord. Does that make sense?
Yeah, mundane, and also we can say, according to this description, dualists. Because yes. We don't see oneness, actually.
No, they are dualists, though they'll claim to be one. But if there's one, then the Shakti then should be Brahman. And then the problem comes if they say Shakti is Brahman, because they don't understand the variety, then they'll say Brahman has to be transforming. So then the philosophy falls apart. So it's just right at that point, just from the gate, it's off. You know? So that's so technically, according to proper philosophy, they don't get out of the gate. You know? Because right there, Brahman and the energies, because the material world's a transformation of energies, where does that come from? Right? You know, they'll have all kinds of fancy ways to say it, but they're just saying nothing. You know, it's like the corporate speak. They can say, yes, you know, last quarter and this and that, and go on and say all this kind of stuff that didn't say anything. It just kind of means we're not doing so well and we're looking into it. But it makes it sound like, you know, everything's so fabulous and it's all... Yeah.
So it's something like this American idea that if I cannot do it, nobody else can do it. So
of course. I mean, is there something that a non-American do that an American can't do? It's just like, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you also have the other American aphorism. If you can do it, I can do it better.
Positive.
Yeah, it's more positive.
But then the question comes, who is American?
Yes, that is the problem. How do you define? Because according to some, Trump wouldn't be American. Others will say he's all American. So. There seems to be a wide range of opinions here. It is understood from this quotation that the Lord has a form because it says that one sees nothing else. The Lord must be able to speak because it says one hears nothing else except Him. Because if you can see nothing else, it means you have to be able to see. There must be an object. Here, there must be an object. One must be able to speak because it says one hears nothing else except him. These statements are representative of touching, smelling, and tasting as well. For it is said, sarva gandha sarva rasa. The Lord is all fragrance and all taste. Chandogya Upanishad 3:14-4. Right, so they'll say these things in different places. They're bringing them up. So the point is Vedanta Sutra then brings those all together in one place.
Yes.
But it'll be in the same kind of same kind of field of discussion.
Yes.
So it's not so easily accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bhagavatam is the natural commentary. Though we see all the acharyas have commented in this field, so that those who want to look at it from that more scholarly or that kind of position can and see that it's all explained. But Bhagavatam then is the very clear, down to earth. Practical, how you're going to apply it. Don't the Upanishads do say, but certainly so.
Is it why it is one of the duty to study the Vedanta Sutra, the sannyasi to study Vedanta Sutra and Upanishad?
That's why it is, but for us the main is Bhagavatam.
Yes.
So we're studying it in the context of what the Acharyas have given us, in that what relates to others in the philosophy. So just to study means, for us, The studying of the Vedanta Sutra basically means the studying of this context of what deals with the philosophies.
Yes.
And all that. Because the essence has already been given in the Bhagavatam. So then we just have to see that context, how to establish that conclusion to the Bhagavatam.
Yes.
But we do it in the context of the Vedanta Sutra.
Yes.
Maharaj, can you say that the Upanishads, from the Vaishnava point of view, deal with the Bhagavan aspect? Because sometimes many of the other Hindus, they derive Paramatma, Brahman, and some.
It deals with all the aspects, but its point is in the Vedas, the ultimate is always about devotional service. So it's always about Bhagavan. So it's Bhagavan, then there's the Paramatma and Brahman aspects. So the Upanishads are explaining a Chintaveda Veda Tattva.
Yes.
Like that. And that's what the Veda is saying, but the essence of that is given in the Upanishads. Then it's a little more clear in the Vedanta Sutra, and then in the Bhagavatam it's the most clear. Right? Because in there is that Vedanta Sutra, then he's explaining all this from the Vaishnava view, but not so, it's not centered on Achinta Veda Veda Tattva. But because you're working with the field that's dealing in that, naturally it'll have it there, but it's not necessarily articulated. Just like, let's say you're doing something and it's correct, but you don't necessarily know why. And then someone else says something, and then you go, oh, that's what's going on. Like that. So now, having heard from his spiritual master, then meditating on that, then he comes up with then he realizes it's a Chinta Veda Veda Tattva. That's why it mentions about the Lord, his energies, and how the energies are under his control, and all his transcendental position, because that actually establishes his relationship with the energies. So the sambandha is proper. So Achinta Veda Veda Tattva is the actual relationship between the Lord and his energies. And from that, because it's the complete philosophy, it will take you to the complete realm. It will take you to Braj. While the other Vaishnava philosophies, they're, you could say, in themselves complete. Complete, more complete, most complete. So most Achinta Veda Veda Tattva will be the most complete.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get very close with Dvait Advait.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That'll get you into Dwarka and Mathura and Lower Vrindavan, like that. These kind of things like that. So that'll be more complete. And then what Ramanuja, Madhva, they're giving, that's complete. And so that'll get you to Vaikuntha. So that's why there's certain aspects they don't necessarily catch.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter, because it's about the Lord, and if it's about the Lord, it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no fault. It's just that you can take it a bit further. So it just becomes easier in the Chinta Veda Veda Tattva. Because we can go right in there and deal on that platform.
Exactly. Because in this particular definition of variety that you just now explained for Prabhu's question, that is well understood by Achinta Veda Veda.
Yes, it's all very easy. You can see is that when you understand Achinta Veda Veda Tattva, that's what the Shastra is talking about.
Yes.
That's actually what it's saying. But from that, you can also take a part of that complete absolute truth, and it's still complete in itself. by Om Purnamidah Purnamidam. So they're taking that one aspect out. And then there's a variety of the oneness. So then Ramanujacharya gives one aspect, Vishnuswami gives another, Nimbarka gives another. You know, Madhva doesn't deal with that because he's the last one to come along, and so therefore those who are impersonalists have not surrendered, those who are left who haven't surrendered, so he's not even going to discuss oneness. You know, he's just going to hammer them with two. Like that. Does that make sense? Because you can see is that it's not just that, because when he talks about in the spiritual world, in a relationship with the Lord in the spiritual world, then he'll be talking more similar to Ramanujacharya. Like that. But within in the material world and in preaching, then his point is no. Because it's not that it's wrong, but because these Maya bodies, because it has the element of oneness in it, they're not seriously giving up their philosophy. So therefore, for them, it doesn't work. That's why it's removed. Not that he has a problem with Ramanujacharya. You know, that neophytes may try to make a case on that there's some difference there and some problem between. There's no problem. You know what I'm saying? Because if you're dealing with something that works on a higher class of intelligence or situation or people, it's more refined. If you're dealing with those who are less refined, it won't work. So for Ramanujacharya, it worked very well, and he did so. But there's still some left, some dregs. So then that Madhvacharya is coming along, right? Put on the bobber boots and, you know. Yes?
Since Mayavada is the base for both materialism and cheating religions, is it so?
Yeah. Yes, you could say that. But you could also basically just say, since we're dealing with the concept of oneness, you could put the Mayavad cheating religion all together as one thing. Because cheating just means you don't see it in connection with the Lord, where the Lord as a person is eternal. Any other view is technically cheating, even if you're following the scriptures very properly. The Karmi is following everything. He's a good smarta. He's a nice smarta. You know, deserves a pat on the head, a little gold star, you know, the whole thing. But still, he's not seeing it in the context of the Lord, you know, being eternal. And that, you know, he's in control of all this. So, because of that, it's actually cheating. Because what's the benefit he'll get from that religious process?
No spiritual benefit.
No spiritual benefit. So, is that actually of any value to the soul? No. So, you're cheating the soul. So a real relationship is the soul's eternal relationship with the Lord. That's real.
Yes.
Everything else is cheating. There's nice cheating and not nice cheating.
I wanted to say soul cheating and hard cheating.
Hard cheating, yes, exactly. You know, just like, let's say, the mother gets the child to take the medicine. Right? So there's a cheating, but she's doing it in a nice way, you know, taking a, oh, so nice, yeah, and the kid takes it. Yeah. So there's always that aspect, but it's just a matter of, is they're just getting a better result, but it's still material. So it may be nice, it may be caring, it may be community, it may be all nice things, it may be prosperous. But if it's not actually based on the relationship between the eternal relationship of the soul with the Lord based on bhakti and engaging the material, your facility in the Lord's service, it is cheating. But because the following the shastra means, in other words, for the one who's the theist, means then they accept shastra. Right? So the then that's considered better than not accepting. Right? Because as we said, you know, as we discussed in the earlier, you have a typical Hindu, then, you know, they'll have a program at their house. You can go there. You can give lecture. You can chant. You can do kirtan. You know, you can, like that. You know, there'll be prasad. So all transcendental activities, because of their accommodating nature, because it falls within the religious processes given in the Veda. Right? So even though they themselves is cheating religion, but because there's a loophole there. And so that loophole means that they're inviting over sadhus, so by chance they could invite over Vaishnavas. And then in that case, now they're connected to the eternal. But the process is still the same process. So now, once it's brought to that point of serving the Lord, that in that devotion, their process doesn't change. They still do the same things. They're still going to cook, but now they'll be cooking for Krishna. Right? You know, their altar might become a little simplified. But the principle will be the same. They're still in the morning, do their puja and ring the bell and make the offerings and you know, offer obeisances and light lamps, and you know, they're still going to do the same stuff. You just have to be able to tell what's actually the real religion, what is the natural forms of the real religion, and what's the distortions of the natural forms. Because if you understand distortion, you know what it should be. Right? There's a demigod on the altar. It's distorted. It should be Krishna. The idea is the demigods there throw the whole thing out. Then that's a problem. So when there's no discrimination, then you see that preachers have to throw the whole thing out. Like Buddha, he just tossed the whole thing out. And so then you get that. So other world religions, they just have to toss everything out. Right? Does that make sense? You know, because as soon as there's a deity of any sort, they get distracted. You know? And then whatever little bit is accepted, that they're not really like the Catholics, they're not really doing deity worship, but there's kind of you can have forms and all that, that's okay. But when you go into the Protestant, they get rid of all that also. So it's just nothing. So basically, you know, you can turn your living room into, you know, if you took all the furniture out of your living room, then you could turn it into a church. Because if you left the furniture, it's a little bit too Catholic, you know, yeah. You know, so that's it. You just get rid of everything. So it's just, they can't discriminate. So as soon as that little bit's there, then, oh, so we can do that. That's the problem. So that's why it takes purification and all that to be able to accept. That's why it'll be easier, as Prabhu said, for the Westerners to catch the philosophy first. Because there's no samskar in discriminating in the religion. And then as the heart's purified, then you can start being trained. But that training can start from immediate, but it may take some years to realize it. But if it starts from the beginning, then, you know, within a few years they can work with it. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So they give philosophy for it all, Mahārāja.
They give?
They give philosophy for it all, reasoning why to be in Maya.
Basically, their philosophy covers everything, though their intent's not that. It means those who are, let's say, more serious about liberation, they're not generally the ones out and talking to the public. Like that. Then you may have some that do, and then some people will come. But the ones that are super popular, they're basically kind of doing that because they like being popular. Because they just say anything, whatever they think will catch attention. It's just like, you know, some, I think the latest guy that just came up, some guy from Kerala. So, you know, he'll be saying all funny things about Krishna. But now if you go back some years, you couldn't say like that because everybody respected it. You know, you can only say that if you were talking to Shaivites, maybe. You know, then they would go for it. But, you know, he's saying in the general audience, and that because now it's accepted, you know, especially on the West Coast, because that's where he's big, is that, you know, they're taking this modern lifestyle and they don't care for all these things. We're independent. We don't, you know, we're breaking away. We're out working out of the box and everything, you know. Yeah, the 1950s, a Western box. You know what I'm saying? How they dress, how they talk. It's so 1950s. You know, like that. Some of them are getting a bit up to the 60s. You know, like that. So that's the difficulty, is that their concept is just, they think they're doing something different, and that's the same thing that's always going on. Does that make sense? So the whole point is most of these Mayavadis, it just works. It's just how you can, you know, the distinction, adoration, and profit works very nicely with Mayavad philosophy because it can accommodate anything. Even if they say something that in detail contradicts or somebody doesn't like, you can explain it how they'll like it. That's the thing. You can do anything with it. Right? Because its principle is anything goes. Well, for us, it's always about Krishna. So when we explain it always how it connects to Krishna, that's what makes it work. And there, it's always how it connects to you and what you feel like doing. So that's why that'll work. Does that make sense? So they're just taking the opposite. You know, the principle is the same. They're just replacing Krishna with ourselves. So now there's a philosophy to establish why our decision in the beginning to get envious of Krishna was okay. You know, just when they have a doubt, you know, when they take up spiritual life, you're supposed to take them away from that. But they just establish them in that. So it's a disturbance. That's why they're the worst. Like that. Karmis are better. Like that. Okay. We should stop them. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaneta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premananda.